This evening we have a futuristic double act, Professor Mark Maslin and Professor Dan Dorgan, here to speak on the geography of the future. Mark Maslin is Professor of Climatology at the University College London. His expertise is passed over the regional climate change, has led to the publication of over 145 papers in journals such as Science, Nature and The Lancet. Other areas of scientific expertise include causes of past and future global climate change and its effects on the global carbon cycle, biodiversity, rainforests and human evolution. Mark's new book on that subject is coming out next January or February. Mark's also written 8 popular books. Many of you, I'm sure, have climate change's very short introduction on your shelves. Among his other appointments, Mark is director of the London NERC Doctoral Training Partnership and is a member of the Cheltenham Science Festival Advisory Committee. Our co-speaker, Dan Dorgan, is a professor of geography at the University of Oxford. Dan's work concerns issues of housing, health, employment, education, wealth, and poverty. He's published with colleagues more than a dozen books on issues related to social inequalities in Britain and several hundred journal papers. If you look outside, you'll see his wonderful atlas of the real world and people and places, 21st century atlas of the UK. Danny is a member of Public Health England, the Mortality Surveillance Steering Group, the Economics and Health Special Interest Group, and the People Data Advisory Group at the University of Oxford. In 2015, Danny was appointed Senior Associate Member of the Royal Society of Medicine. In 2009, Danny was awarded the RGS Back Award here for Scientific Geographical Studies, which make an outstanding contribution to the development of national or international public policy. Both Danny and Mark are fellows of RGS IBG, and this evening they're going to explore how acknowledging and embracing humanity's role as a geological superpower might help us to protect Earth's environment and its peoples. You'll be very welcome, please, to Danny and Mark.
Thank you very much for those very kind words of introduction. I'm Mark. This is Danny. Just so you don't get confused. Now, what we would like to do today is something quite unique. Very rarely do you actually see a physical geographer, myself, and a human geographer on the same stage when we're not fighting. So we're hopefully going to try and give you an idea about how geography is the actual subject for the 21st century, and why the combination of science and social science is so important for the future of the planet. So, that's to give you the first slide. So, what I want to start off with is, are we in the Anthropocene? Now, the Anthropocene has grown out of a debate over the last 10 years that we humans are now so powerful in our effect on the environment that we have actually become a geological superpower. If we are as powerful as plate tectonics or meteorite impact on the Earth, maybe we should define the current geological period after us because of our influence. And perhaps we should be not in the Holocene, but in the Anthropocene epoch. So, as a scientist, can I see some of the evidence? So one of the interesting new developments is people have started talking about planetary boundaries. So these are 9 boundaries in the environment whereby scientists feel that we are pushing the boundary from what we would expect to be healthy and natural to things that can be dangerous for us. Okay? And the boundaries are defined by what could be dangerous to humanity. So as you can see, you've got climate change here, you've got biodiversity here, land use, fresh water, biogeochemical flows, ocean acidification, aerosols, you've got ozone here, and I love this one, novel entities. So this is the scientist's get out clause, which is these are things that we know are going to be produced in labs, could be released, and we have no idea if they're going to be. But we're just going to speed up there just to remind you to be careful. So, can I actually use these boundaries to say we really are a geological superpower. So if we top here on the top left, half the nitrogen that are fixed into ammonia to be used by plants in the world is fixed by humans. The Haber-Bosch process that came out of the Second World War to produce ammonia to make big bombs actually makes ammonia for fertilizer. The last time the nitrogen cycle on the planet was so disrupted was 2.5 billion years ago. That's the first one. Second one should know that we need no reduction in climate change. We have increased CO2 by over 40% in 100 years. These are the ice ages, and look how far we are away from that. And with methane gas, we're even further, we've actually doubled the amount in the atmosphere. So climate change, that's that. So let's go on to the other side. How about land use? The green on the planet is where we use more than 30% of the land for agriculture. 25% of all the land surface on the Earth, including Antarctica and Greenland, is used by humans for our own productivity, whether it has to be cattle, whether it has to be farming, or whether it has to be where we live. And then here, we are definitely entering the sixth mass extinction. This is the historic extinction rate, this is where we are, which is 100 times higher, and this is what is modeled into the future. So, I would argue, and many scientists now agree, we are definitely in the Anthropocene. Now, this is a fantastic piece of work. This is the ultimate piece of science. Yes, so we have to actually thank the geologists. So this is, of course, the geological timescale going from the Archaea all the way through to the Paleocene and up into the recent here. This is an amazing piece of work because they define each of these beautiful boundaries here all the way between Jurassic and the Cretaceous by golden spikes. A single location around the world that has a beautiful stratigraphic layer that can tell you where, which era you are in. Interestingly enough, most of them are in the UK because, of course, we had the first rise of the geologists and natural scientists during the Victorian period. So, we are currently in the Holocene. Okay, so here's the Holocene, parts of the Quaternary period, which started 11,000 years ago. But the argument is, here's CO2 rising at the end of the last ice age, here's temperature, and it's defined here by the warmest point at the end of the last ice age. So that's the Holocene. But somewhere in here is where human influence starts. And this is what we want to investigate because the influence and the politics seem to go hand in hand. Why I and Danny can work together. So let's start. Early agriculture and the age of empire. So is it all the agricultures? So we know that at the end of the last ice age, about 10,000 years ago, farming spontaneously occurred in about four different locations. Far East, the Middle East, Africa, and Central and South America. Now, it's always been assumed that these farmers had very little influence on the actual climate. Until Bill Ruthven came along and said, well, hang on, if we look at ice cores, every interglacial, methane starts high, goes down. We look at CO2 during every other ice age, the interglacial we know, starts high, goes down. His genius was to notice that our Holocene is slightly different. It goes down, ooh, and then it comes up. And it goes down, it goes up. Now this is not industrialization because this is occurring about 5,000 years ago, and this is occurring about 7,000 years ago. So, what he was able to ascertain is that those early farmers, by actually clearing forests, by planting wet, cultivated rice in the Far East, were having huge effects on methane and on CO2. So perhaps it's the early farmers. Perhaps they are when we started to have that planetary influence. However, We then move into the age of empire, so I'm just putting up the Roman Empire, they are, they're Sodom. Okay? They resisted, okay? Whereas this was the whole of the empire, by the way, Danny's not from Scotland, so it's not me in Sodom, okay? I'll get to Oxford in a minute. And this is the empire. But it had very little influence on the global climate or the environment. And what you find is that if you look at the last 10,000 years here, you can see that the CO2-wise I showed you here, and the methane here, if you put them in context of the last 100 years, the small changes that the farmers made were so insignificant compared to what we've done in methane, CO2, soil erosion, deforestation, and spread of agriculture over the last just 100-150 years. Okay? Now, it is true that some of my colleagues also argue that those early farmers just hit the balance enough so we didn't go into the next ice age. However, in terms of scale, we can't be blaming them for the Anthropocene. So, globalization of humanity and the dawn of capitalism. Okay? So, Christopher Columbus. Yeah, actually it's all downhill from 1492. Okay? So, the rediscovery, let's keep it correct, the rediscovery of the Americas by white Europeans had a huge effect. The first thing is that the new and old world became joined for the first time for 10,000 years in terms of humanity, but in terms of other creatures for tens of millions of years. So this exchange, called the Columbian Exchange, from the Americas to Europe, we got maize, potatoes, beans, peanuts, we got tomatoes, avocados, tobacco, quinine. And on the export side, we've got wheat, sugar, bananas, rice, grape, dandelions, cattle, goats, all the way down there. Yeah, we also gave them smallpox, measles, typhus. Okay? Not a balanced exchange. Okay? Now, this is still ongoing. Many of you will know and have heard wonderful talks here about the problem of exotic species being brought into this country and around the world. Again, this exchange, this global exchange of mating the new and old world is continuing. I'll let you into a little secret. In America, the majority of earthworms are European, okay? Because unfortunately, native worms just run up to it. And so where the Europeans have got it, basically the earthworms took over. Again, think about it. That's something we cannot reverse. There is no way that we can go through the whole of North America and extract all the European earthworms and return the Americans to prominence. Okay? So this is what causes exchange. Look at the incredible exchange between different countries. This is just a map of the shipping logs. There is no map underneath it. That is just the ship tracks. Okay? So, again, we had one minor effect of this, which was because we had brought all those diseases over, 50 million people died in the Americas due to smallpox. There are stories written documenting the Spanish turning up to cities, and the whole city was already dead, because the disease had spread faster than the conquistadors could actually get to the cities to rape, pillage, and steal all the gold. Okay? However, this had one major effect. It meant that the whole continent was depopulated and provided food and resources for Europe to continue its economic development on the pathway towards industrialization. So, Simon Lewis and myself in Nature last year caused a huge stir by saying, well, how about the Anthropocene starts at 1610? Because the deforestation had occurred due to the early farmers, 50 million people being supported by agriculture. When they all died, the forest grew back. And so much forest and savanna grew back that CO2 in the atmosphere actually went down. So all that CO2 being brought into the trees and plants. And this is the last time we have a dip in CO2 before, of course, it takes off due to climate change. So we suggested that 1610, that's a beautiful ring to it as well, okay? 1610 would be perhaps a good start for the Anthropocene. But that's not all that changed.
A great deal changed. This is the first time I've ever shared the stage with a physical geographer. This is the biggest change, but it is interesting. And because for most of my career in geographers, we got on very well with some of the geographers because we had so little in common. So we didn't have to argue about sharing and teaching, we just said that's yours, it's mine. Physical geographers would be really used to, but they still do, they like to climb up mountains. And then excuse the public announcements as they were going to measure just how fast the glaciers were coming down. And it did take them quite a few years to realise that they weren't coming down. You and your first people who really want to be sociologists, and then something else, but we've come to the path. What's been happening recently is forcing us to come together. What you're seeing behind you is one of the first claims that the Earth is at the centre of the universe. And that came shortly after we realised that there was another world on our planet. Things really did change in 1492, politically, socially, philosophically. It's the connection between those things. We will get to the future, but it's our shared recognition of the key important dates in the past, which I think is one of the most remarkable things. Shortly after 1610, René Descartes was standing on the dockside in Amsterdam, saying, in effect, all around me is badness. People appear to be taken over by the love of money. They are doing whatever they can to become richer and richer and richer. You might think it's the kind of equivalent of Canary Wharf, a few, before 2008. It was an incredible change, the beginning of capitalism, the beginning of mercantile trade, just producing more and more and more wealth. And it was recognised as a shock at the time. I've got one table of figures for you, just to show you what was happening in what is now called the Netherlands, how fast the population explosion was in the Netherlands, particularly in the 17th century when René Descartes was writing, but also look at the United Kingdom. We took over from the United Provinces and became the engine of world growth after the madness of the dockside in Amsterdam. And then look down to China and see the population decline in China. China has no interest in the rest of the world because the rest of the world had very little to give China until 1492. And until the one thing the Chinese wanted, which was silver for their currency, began to arrive in amounts that simply couldn't be imagined. And suddenly this place where we are, which was a cold edge of a continent, which nobody really wanted to get to, which the Romans had stopped halfway through, this place became the centre of the world. You can see at the bottom of that chart just how devastating the crossing over in 1492 was to the population in the southern of the continent. And we're going to talk a lot about population because this matters for the future. Charles Darwin, in The Origin of Species, has a particular section where he talks about the amazing explosion in the number of elephants that can occur if elephants have a few favoured seasons. If everything is just right for elephants, then the numbers can increase sixfold in just a few generations. He also looked at lettuces, but mainly other mammals. What Charles Darwin could never have realised was at the time he was writing about the effect of a few favourable seasons. Those few favourable seasons were about to begin for his own species. And in 150 years after he was writing, the human population increased sixfold. The only time that has happened before on the planet was during the Neolithic Revolution. A very, very long time ago, and it took longer. Here's the graph of the change in population each year, how much population rises each year from 1850 through to the present day. The increase itself was increasing all the way to 1971. If you look carefully, you can see the four horsemen of the apocalypse, in particular events, pandemic, war, famine, that punctuated that rise. But other than those events, the growth in population was itself growing until 1971, and then something happened, and the growth began to reduce. There was one small blip in the 1980s associated with East African famine, but that production has carried on. This is a reduction for, I think, all of your lifetime, and almost all of my lifetime. People have been having fewer and fewer babies, and in the last 5 years, we've seen the biggest drop in fertility worldwide. Now, the last 5 years are 5 years of great global recession, so we can't be sure, but it looks as if something has changed. Let's go back. The fact is, that's the revolution and why this matters in terms of climate change. Matters because of coal. We had already cut down most of our woodland. We cut it down for many reasons, but one of which was to fight the Spanish and producing of ships. So we thought we were safer than the Spanish. Why were we fighting the Spanish? Because the Spanish got the steel from America. First, what were our ships doing? Some of them were defending us, and some of them were out in the Caribbean attacking other Spanish ships. For that silver. We cut down the wood, so we had to dig the coal. And we developed so much coal out of the ground in this country that when you look at particles of carbon in the atmosphere now, I'm afraid we come out as the worst country in the world in terms of our legacy of pollution. But that coal allowed other things to happen. It allowed industrialization to happen, it allowed us to get away from having to use horsepower and human power, and has allowed population growth to begin to explode. It also changed thinking. If it hadn't been Karl Marx, it would have been somebody else in London at the time who would have pointed out that this was unsustainable, what was going on. The changes in human beliefs over this period, since 1610, are incredible. Generation after generation, people begin to believe different things about what should happen, what has happened, what are we living in, because it is changing so incredibly quickly. And then we get up to our current era. The great acceleration of population that we commonly see within just a dozen years, an extra billion people on the planet. It's easy to panic when you see that, but most of that increase is because people are not dying. Most of it is aging, most of the population that might succumb is aging. And at the same time, you get the birth of neoliberalism from the early 1980s onwards. But before that, if you're going to be hopeful, we also see unprecedented global cooperation. We failed in the League of Nations after the First World War, but arguably the United Nations has been much, much more successful. If you look at the Sustainable Development Goals of the you couldn't have predicted 30 years ago that the UN would have managed to get those goals through, and all of those goals would include a commitment to reduce economic inequality. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund came out of this too, much criticised, but far better to happen than not to happen. And they were all products of the Bretton Woods Agreement, which held together until the 1970s, when America could no longer afford to keep to the goals. So we know by fits and starts to understanding better how our world works and how it is changing. But all the time, we are using more and more energy. It's not so much the increase in population that matters, it's the increase in people living highly energy intensive lives. And when the coal begins to run out, we begin to use other sources and more sources. You won't see solar here or wind here because it is still too small. And that is the fear for the future, that we will burn all the rest of it. Mark came with this slide. It's about trying to work out when things get out of control, when the peace is there. The red line is traced left from the nuclear testing in the Pacific that can now be seen. One of the blue lines is apparently the number of McDonald's stores in the world. There's numerous ways of saying things appear to be going out of control. We really can't control what people are doing. Okay, our fertility has dropped, but people want more and more goods. And if they have those goods, then the energy required to produce them will be far more than the planet can actually sustain. But look at population. We're going to show you about three or four of these, I have to warn you. This is the United Nations predictions from a few years ago. Everybody concentrates about the middle line, the blue line, the what they call the median projection. We're going to hit them, they said about 9 million people by the end of the century dropping to 9.5 million. People worry about the red line. The red line is a higher variant line in the UN, and all it is what happens if the average woman in the world has half an extra baby. That's how we want to see it. Half an extra baby, and the green line, which nobody looks at, is what happens if you have half less a baby each. In the last 5 years, fertility has moved more towards the lower variant than the middle variant. May not say, it's worth thinking where we are really heading. This is what our planet looks like when you shape it in terms of people today. This map was produced by Mark Newman, who's a physicist, so he's been in science. I'm very jealous, I've never got into science, made sure all the masses. But this can't come up here in science, but it shows you the planet shaped by people. And it's not going to change very much in the future. Japan's going to get a bit smaller. China will get a bit smaller. India will get a bit bigger, but you won't just be able to see it. Africa will get quite a lot bigger. Back to its share of global population it last had before the transatlantic slave trade began. And Europe is going to shrink back to the size it was before the transatlantic slave trade began. But you are looking here at the population distribution largely of the future. Give or take a few hundred million migrants, one way or another. Let's show you some more conditions the world for this way. This is a map of where we currently think we have so much energy that we can use it to light up the sky so that satellites can draw a nice picture of the world. It's a population cartogram, so if an area is dark, there are still people living there. But they are becoming forced away so that it's just still their habit or they're sensible enough not to shine it up. If you look at this changing over time, it's a good news story. Places like Tokyo have actually become darker, but places like Cairo have become brighter. This is where our food comes from. We rely on the planet now for our food. We are one set to 7.3, 7.4. billion people. It would not be possible to generate our food locally. These are the areas that are really going to matter for us in the future. Here, every small arc section on the planet has been drawn in proportion to the amount of cereal that's produced. And you may worry, you may say, well, we're going to get 9 or 10 billion people, so how are we going to manage to feed people when we've got finite amounts of space to produce cereals? And of course there are numerous answers. One is not to waste 50% of it, the other is not to feed so much for animals, because eating that amount of meat really isn't that good for us. You can move forward from food to worry about how are we going to get away from people? What's going to happen when there are these extra people? What's it going to be like in London when the population of London rises? But if you look at the geographical trends, you'll see that in fact we're getting more wilderness. As people move from the countryside to the cities, as London becomes more dense, other areas are becoming depopulated. We have walls moving across Europe now, heading westward. If you want to get away from it all at the moment, these are the places to go. This is land area shaped by how far it is away from the biggest city of 50,000 people. But there will be more places like this in the future if the trends of the last 40 years continue. High density in the cities, which can be very low consumption, so no need to drive a car in a city like London, and most of us cannot afford a parking space anyway, which is good things for the planet. But neoliberalism. When you take the long historical view, this is much less of a problem than when it's been the main driving ideology of your entire adult life. But if it has been the main driving ideology of your adult life, it can be somewhat depressing. Neoliberalism is partly the idea that the markets are just sorted out. It'll all balance somehow and it'll all be fine. That doesn't work, and given what we know about what is happening in terms of pollution, we cannot simply carry on going along with that. We partly can't go along with it because there are still so many bad news stories in the world. Now, all of these are getting better. There are still 7 million children who die needlessly every year, 6,000 who die in this country, the highest rate of child mortality in Europe, apart from Romania. So we're not ashamed of people for that. But the numbers are dropping everywhere. And in the best year ever, a few years ago, we thought that we'd have 5,000 more years. 700 million people go to bed hungry every night. 15 years ago, that was a billion. So things are getting better. A million people have no access to clean drinking water. That is entirely solvable at very, very low cost. You only need so much water to drink. It is not an infinite amount. But we are not sharing things out there. Although the global middle class has got larger, and although there has been poverty alleviation at the very bottom, at the top of global society, we have seen an incredible rise in the take of the very richest 1%. And particularly the richest 1% of the 1% of the 1%. The squeezed middle in the world income distribution is actually people like you. It's people in one of the best off countries, but not in the Sunday Times rich list. The Sunday Times rich list has come out again this weekend, saw a doubling of wealth in just 5 years for the richest 1,000 people. Globally, we're looking at, if you believe Oxfam now, well, Oxfam Credit Suisse is the same data source. You're looking at 60, 65 people having half of the world's wealth. Is this a problem? Surely they can regard it very well. What you find when you compare countries is that countries which have the most economic inequality, such as the United States, the average citizen pollutes 4 times more than a planet can take. In countries with much greater economic equality, like Japan, the figures are twice as good as that. The message is that incredible inequality doesn't give you environmental sustainability. And now, I hand over to Mark for the future.
Beautifully seen, sir. So, the question for us is, why do we worry about neoliberalism? Why do we worry about that inequality that occurs both in country and between countries? And it's because of the future, and this is where geography can make a real contribution to the debate and also the solutions. So the first thing is, let's look at the future. John Livingston, who was the previous chief science advisor to the government, he called it the perfect storm. So in the next 14 years, this is not far future, next 14 years, energy demand in the world will increase by 50%. The amount of food demand will increase by 50%. Now that is not to feed the starving millions, it is actually because of the increased demand of food by the burgeoning middle classes across the world, particularly meat production. And of course, to feed all that, we need extra water for the energy and for the food, and it's suggested that we need to increase water demand by 30% in the next 14 years. We have two stresses on that, which is of course development, because we need rapid development to lift huge chunks of the world's population out of extreme poverty, and we also have the population growth, which is, okay, admittedly only 1 to 2 billion over the next sort of like 20 years, but again, significant in particular countries. And right in the heart of this, very insidiously, is climate change. So, climate change. If we have a look at the models, and I know you've all been to climate change course here at the RGS. I'm only going to show you two futures. So this is business as usual. So as you can see, 39 models from around the world suggest we're aiming for 4 degrees up to 6 degrees. I call this the W.D. Bush view of the future, okay, which is great, the Arctic's melting, we can get more oil out of it. So that's the business as usual. And we are currently on that track. This one is the politically motivated 2 degrees. So IPCC were asked by the politician, please show us what we have to do to keep our pledge to 2 degrees. And this is what we need to do to keep to 2 degrees. Now, Paris was absolutely amazing. We came away with an international agreement that was actually signed over the weekend by 170 countries. It says that we are going as a global population to keep climate change to below 2 degrees. There's even discussion that perhaps we're aiming for 1.5 degrees. So, let me show you what that means in reality. So this is business as usual, as you see, just going up. This is where we are now here. This is the 2 degree world in emissions of gigatons of carbon per year. So it says that by 2020, we must start reducing global emissions by the same rate we have been increasing it all the way up to 2070. And then this is the real number. In 2070, we have to have negative global emissions for us to keep to the 2 degree target. Yeah, I'm not even sure how we get the world to reduce its actual emissions, let alone how we go to negative emissions. So that's the actual challenge that the politicians have set themselves and ourselves. Okay? So, now, So, the problem that both Danny and I have is, of course, I usually work in the climate change arena, Danny works on population, and the interesting thing is both produce the same hysteria. It's all about having too many people, it's all those poor people producing too much pollution, it's all their fault. So, we have a look at the projections there. Oh, this is the medium and this is the maximum minimum again. And I'll just point out that one of the most important things with this shift in population is, of course, women's education. Now, guys, I know you think you're in control. Let me let you into a secret. You're not, okay? As soon as women are educated up to secondary school level, you find in almost every single society, they take control of their fertility and they plan when they're having children and how many, even though they think, we think, that we're making those decisions. And seriously, I'm going to ask that to Danny, because of course he made all the decisions in his household.
There's a huge variation in how many children people will have in their household. But globally, the average woman in the world wants half a child less than her male partner wants. So what matters is the power. And when women get more power, they get the power they want. And when they don't have power, the man gets what he wants and you have more children. You're seeing an incredible renaissance around women. There are now more female graduates on the planet than male graduates, which by far the largest number are in China. And in China, of course, they've just been given the choice again to have 2 children rather than 1 child. And the predictions are that most will not choose to have 2 children. We can see cities around the world, not just in China, but in Barcelona, where 1 child is now the median, the norm, which means the population halving in 1 generation. The last graph, the further the population change, because these figures are not stable. The top graph shows you projections the UN released in 2004 based on 2003 data. The plan gets into 9 billion people by the end of the century, 8.5 by 2150. And the climate change model is a man with long term figures, so the demographer supplies some fairly dodgy long-term appeals. This one down here shows the update in 2011. And the middle range has gone from predicting 9 billion people by the end of the century to 10 billion people. So I decided to write a book called Population of 10 billion based on that. But at the bottom, the one that we looked at, 6 billion, just half a child less. The higher rate, almost 16 billion of people worry about bravely. In fact, 16 billion people behaving well is far more sustainable than 6 billion people behaving badly. And the top line has been added. That's a constant fertility rate. There's no decline whatsoever. I don't know who insisted that that be added, but it was added. And because it was added, the graph had to stop here, because there is no legend in the planet behind the screen to take that forward in a few decades. That does show what would happen if we suddenly didn't see fertility decline. And then, I haven't got the figures because I still find it too galling, 1 week before my book, Population 10 Billion, was published, the UN released another report saying it'll be 11 million. I didn't take it too personally, but I did look into it. And what has happened? The UN demographers are just a small group of people sitting in an office halfway up that skyscraper in New York. They get a lot of good advice, but they also change their projections very, very often. We have had the tail end of a baby boom. There was a massive baby boom after the Second World War. It wasn't just in the West, it wasn't just in America, it wasn't just here. It was also in India with independence, and it was in China with the revolution. And then there was the children of those baby booms. We are the children of those baby booms. With the 1960s, 1970s first. And then things got really low. Very low fertility in the late 1970s and 80s. But then we have children, and you get another baby boom. And those children got picked up in the projections, and people suddenly say there's going to be another million and another million. And now, part of the reason for the last 5 years seeing such a rapid decline in fertility are the ending of those echoes to pass worldwide baby booms. But also the global economic recession, but also the emancipation of women, the spread of social security systems around the world, the idea that you do not have to have that extra child as a form of economic security for your old age, because collectively you'll deal with your old age in a better way than trying to make sure you've got a daughter. It's always a daughter who will look after you. That's coming to an end, by the way. You'll be glad to know there are no more graphs about it. But there is this graph. The black bars are the incumbent emissions per person, to show you the variation. The United States is the highest, but it's predicted by 2030 to drop, which is good news. Russia's predicted to rise, which it was remained before the current slump in the oil price. Japan shows stability, that was quite good. We're getting better as a whole, but we weren't that good before. China, though, is going to rise as a growing Chinese middle class begin to behave, or we think they'll begin to behave, as we do. Brazil much lower, India much lower. However, that's where we need to. And that's the challenge. That's why you suddenly get physical and human doctors sharing the same stage. Because you don't get that just by producing papers in scientific journals and getting the IPCC to be the same, please could you behave better. You only get something like that if you have a coordinated view that it really is important, and it will require social and political change. And social and political change does happen, has happened in the past, incredible changes. So this is the aversion of almost all war in Europe since 1945. Things people wouldn't have thought possible would have happened. The spread of education to so many people in the world, that we now have incredible numbers of very, very difficult children adults, and most of our literacy is amongst the elderly. Incredible things do change, but that is an incredible thing which needs to change. We need to grow an awful number of very carbon-absorbing trees if we're going to have a chance of being a carbon sink by 2070. And I'm not a scientist, but I do know that if you want to have a large tree growing by 2070, you might need to be planting it now. Because a lot of decisions that have to be made, and the decisions have to be made collectively because they affect us all. But they really reduce our quality of life that much. It doesn't increase your quality of life to have pollution from your cars in the city making the air worse to breathe. It doesn't increase your quality of life if your home is leaking large amounts of heat that you pay to be generated. Holidays, I'm using them to holidays, although we think holidays will make us happy, if you interview people after the event, holidays are actually neutral in terms of happiness. I still think we shouldn't have holidays, but we know there's so much fly to them so often, and we don't need holidays to involve very large amounts of consumption. If we don't, and of course, by the we, it's the people who are consuming the most who have to begin, particularly those who have put most of the coal up into the atmosphere historically. It's not our fault. It was our great-great-grandparents that we happen to be here. We cannot have the current increase in what we call development and population and not avoid faster climate change. But we can also begin to realize the home truth that there is no need for us to have the degree of poverty we have in this country with a wealth is $3 trillion. We can have social improvement, this world improvement, we can move forward, we can have progress without heading towards 6 degrees Celsius rise. And we can learn lessons. In general, this is the life expectancy increase around the world, it's been phenomenal. A third of 30 years, apart from Eastern Europe. Very good things do happen, but that is likely to continue for some time, so we need to prepare for a very elderly worldwide population. Peak baby was 1990, which means we're a peak 26-year-old in the world now. If you're Germany, you've suddenly left in an awfully large number of 26-year-olds. People may say, why is Germany letting in such a large number of 26-year-olds? There's going to be a lack in the future of young people in the world, but we're not anywhere near realizing that. To be sustainable, we need to realize that economic growth needs to be growth which is polluting growth, but growth in other forms of the economy, producing things that appear on the internet which are not necessarily printed on paper. Social change is as important as economic growth now. We have reached a height of development where most of us have most things that we need. We don't need trees anymore. We don't need extra rooms in most of our houses. We have so much housing in this country that we have enough housing for every family to have a spare room. But because we share it out badly, we think we've got to build lots more. And that isn't going to reduce our carbon footprint. And lastly, of course, as you got back down to the apartments, it's just as important as economic and social. And things are coming out and being revealed. This graph, the data was initially produced by the Office of National Statistics, and they then withdrew the data because they said it wasn't reliable. What wasn't reliable is they thought they underestimated the wealth of the best off 1% of the country because they couldn't be sure what it was. George Monbiot very kindly set the data on his website, so you can still use the graph. And now we have the Panama Papers actually allowing us to work out. Admittedly, only for a sample of the very rich people in Canada, what that line really should be like. The journalists have only gone through the first couple of 100,000 Panama Papers. They have over 10 million papers still going through. 170 journalists worked on those papers, So if you work out the salaries of 170 journalists, you can work out how many more stories are going to come. You're going to be sick of it by the end of the summer. And there were three offshore finance firms that were even larger than the one that was leaked. And what do you think is happening in those three largest firms at the moment? You think there might just be a little individual with a lazy sit going, oh, it can work, and I can keep my anonymity. The waste of wealth in the world is being revealed right now. I think Panama is as important as Suez was for changing what it means to be British. And lastly, we did think of putting these masks on your chairs, because we really tried to get into the building, didn't we? I'll hand back to Mark to conclude.
So, again, we've seen that neoliberalism doesn't actually help us in building a better world, and though it was a reaction to socialism in Russia, it hasn't actually produced the global wealth and the rise out of poverty that we were expecting. So again, perhaps we should discuss returning to social democracy, the idea that the governments are there to ensure that all people are actually equally supported and have equal opportunities within a country. Now, interestingly enough, there's a wonderful return to the idea of the universal basic income. So this is a radical idea that comes out, that interestingly, both from the right and the left. Imagine this country got rid of all benefits. Get rid of the benefit system completely. But anybody who is 18 is guaranteed £120 per week. Okay? If they have children, for the first, say, three children, they can have an extra £50 per week. Now that just about gives you the basic amount of money that you can live on. It means that 18-year-olds can go to university and support themselves. And guess what? If you then want to have a better lifestyle, you then go out to work. Interesting thing is that the universal basic income would cost about the same as our welfare system today. So radical thinking by geographers is required to reset our society. Just because everybody, unfortunately, believes nihilism is the actual ultimate aim of a capitalist society, maybe not. Perhaps we can discuss that later. But my bit is to say, why does this matter? Why does the Anthropocene, capitalocene, as human geographers called it, matter to us as geographers and the future? So the first thing is, does it matter calling the current geological period the Anthropocene? Does it matter that we acknowledge our huge impact on the planet? And I would argue, absolutely. I think the Anthropocene as a concept is as powerful as evolution. And the reason is that for the last 500 years, us scientists, I'm sorry, I must take the blame for science, we've told you that you're insignificant. It started off with Copernicus, as Daniela pointed out. We thought we were the centre of the universe. Now, I'm sorry guys, that's the sun. And now, we get people like Brian Cox telling us that our sun is not particularly important, it's rather small, insignificant, and one of 10 to the 24 stars in just our universe. It's pretty small. So, not to be outdone, the biologists get involved, and because we were thinking, that's okay, so we can cope with the sun being the centre. However, we are between animals and angels. But no, we are just a smart, slightly naked ape with no tail. And by the way, Danny also made me put this bit in. You usually get up to this point, but this is industrial man, so this is the Victorian who dropped by about a foot during the Industrial Revolution, and this is post-industrial man or woman, basically about 6 foot. So, see, we can work together, just about. So the biologists have then got into it and said, hey, we're insignificant, we're just part of the evolution. But think about this. If we are a geological superpower, as scientists are now arguing, instead of being insignificant, humanity becomes the most important thing on the planet. We control the environmental and evolutionary destiny of the Earth. We now, if we acknowledge the Anthropocene, we become the most important thing. Therefore, our decisions really do matter. And so to finish off, there is a debate out there about two futures. Okay? We have here the good Anthropocene, where we reduce climate change, we reduce inequality in each country, we allow the 10 billion people by the end of the century all to have lives that we would like to live in happiness, but not necessarily six cars. Okay? So perhaps that is a vision of the future that we geographers can produce for the world. And there's this, which unfortunately most of my students don't get, because of course this film is from the 70s. So of course this is Planet of the Apes, and we learned it all up. We can see visions of the future whereby climate change goes up to 6 degrees, inequality grows, and we have a nightmare scenario. Now Danny and I would argue that geography, particularly geography in this country, because of the synergies and the ability occasionally for human and physical geographers to work together, we can produce the dialogue and the visions for the future to say what decisions we can make. And we have a choice. By we, I mean the highly educated, very rich elites, a very small percentage of the world, that dominates the choices for the future. Thank you very much.
I apologise, I will keep it short.
There is a myth that people don't want to work. Again, you find that in most societies, people want to improve their lot. They want to improve the lot for their children. And therefore, producing a society that gives you choices about how you actually invest your time, and you're not worried about actually just being able to feed yourself, allows you to actually push on in a progressive way. Yes.
First, thank you for the most brilliant lecture we've had for a very, very long time. It was absolutely riveting from start to finish. Two very quick questions. The first is, I was desperately writing down some of the facts and figures. Is there any way we can find some of these slides? Are they on the internet? And the second question is, are you in any way optimistic that those who lead us, the so-called politicians, are listening to a word you're saying? Not just in this country, I mean worldwide.
The first thing is that I'm sure we're very happy to put the talk online so you can access the slides if you're welcome to.
Please do.
If you grab me afterwards in my rucksack, I have copies of the actual physical copies, very strange, of the actual paper we published in Nature, which has quite a lot of the arguments about the Anthropocene and how it's developed. So you're very welcome to have a copy of that.
Thank you.
Ask the politicians, Danny.
Thought to the my department produced Theresa May, so we'll get to that. politicians really would like to be remembered in the future for what good they did. They're often making a terrible job of it, I will only be remembered or be remembered for the bad job they did, but they're generally not a bunch of people who, they're quite egotistical. So I think if you can convince politicians that if they move more in this direction, then they may well be in the history books in the future. Just based on their ego, you can do that. Margaret Thatcher did an incredible thing on the ozone layer, which is largely forgotten now, because it's some of the other things she did. But if we were to, that may be one of the best things she did. Open sources, just a plug, there's a little book called Geography Outside, that Carl Lee and I wrote, and that has some of the maps in it. But over a lecture, I think it's a great idea to get two people to give lectures, because you do have to meet and argue with each other beforehand. So you actually need some equipment for the audience. Thank you very much.
Another question? Yes, back.
You did refer to GDP almost in passing, but there seems to be an unspoken agreement between politicians and voters that we must keep increasing the GDP every year. And this, the success of an economy, successful countries have increasing GDP all the time. How do you get the voters and the politicians to agree that that may not be the best thing for us?
Thank you. So the question is about you, I think. How are you going to persuade politicians in the electorate that economic growth and GDP doesn't have to be continual upward slope?
Yeah. You're completely right. In the brief moment when Gordon Brown was Prime Minister, he had a target for GDP growth, which would have increased world inequality. So it is right across the political spectrum. One thing I think you can do, which is easier than the other thing, is to divide GDP into environmentally good GDP growth, things that actually make you money but don't increase pollution, and GDP growth associated with increased pollution, and measure those differently. The IFS does this. The second thing which is harder is saying, when do you get to a point where you have enough? And you can look at the last two, what the famously called the two lost decades in Japan, of a very rich African country which didn't have much growth. And you can say, does it really hurt the Japanese that much? They still have the highest life expectancy on the planet. Their children are still some of the most able. They still produce the most paintings for heads, for the most innovative people. And that's without much economic growth. But that is much harder to say, we've had enough. It's made hard by economic inequality. Because people immediately say, well, you've got enough because you've got the house and you've got the car. but there are still lots of people who'd like more. And part of the reason people would like more is because we produce selective television that tells people to aspire to having many cars and many houses. And we've got to get away from saying this is how you'll success in life by having lots more than other people have.
I have a more medical suggestion. Which is, I think we need to go and re-educate all the classically trained economists. So, at UCL, wonderful university, much better than that one, I have worked with engineers, I've worked with the medics, I've worked with the lawyers, I've published papers with almost every single discipline in the arts in UCL, except the economics department, which basically produces this little fortress, will not engage with other subjects because they know best. If you could actually change the way that economists are educated in the world, you increase their knowledge of these sort of things. You actually point out the failings of GDP, they will go into governments, they go into companies. And therefore, if you can change that, you will change the mantra of the economic drivers that drive countries. So that's my more radical solution. Or you just get rid of all of them. Oh, has this been filmed? Yes.
Just picking up on a point you made about the impact of the media that we consume, how significant in the unforeseen era is the media production and our dependence on electrostatic and wireless emissions?
So the question is how important is the media, general media?
And our dependence on wireless transmissions and connectivity.
You know more about computers do produce huge amounts of power. Yeah, a Google search, you know, you don't want to get there is a problem. But on the other hand, it's a lot less power than having to actually travel to a library and find the encyclopedia. So we have this big increase in freedom from happiness. The media varies in different countries, particularly in terms of how much it presents energy and how much it doesn't. In the US, they spend 4% of GDP, by the old measure, on advertising. In Europe, it's 2%. In Japan, it's 1%. So you have very different medias in different parts of the world. In small countries, where the media is generally more local, the idea of celebrity is that it's much less lauded. So I can remember in New Zealand, when the main anchor on the main nightly news had her salary rise announced. And people said, that's terrible, she shouldn't be paid that much, because they knew her. And in her family, because they were friends. The same happens in Finland. It doesn't happen in the UK, because we're just probably too big, that people can leave different lives and so many lives in London, which is why ITV can steal BBC talent by increasing their wages to much higher, but already high wages. And it doesn't happen in the US, where the idea is that you'll be fine as long as you make more. I always think the tragedy with celebrities is to compare US celebrities with European ones. Michael Jackson, the rapper, Prince with Jarvis Cocker. It is, as soon as you begin to compare the lives of the super successful in the US with the super successful in Europe, and who choose to still live in Scandinavia or Sheffield, the ones who are still choosing to have their more modest lives appear to be doing much better. And that's the maxim, that's the idea that more and more is better.
We have time for one more question. At the top, please, yes.
What about making geography a compulsory A-level?
What about making geography a compulsory A-level?
Well, we have citizenship studies at GCSE, it's almost compulsory. I think it would be good if we could move away from the three or four A-levels, but at the moment we are restricting our curriculum by getting rid of the AS level element. And that's bad news for geography, because geography did very, very well out of ASs. We haven't got enough time to explain to the old man to the audience, but essentially these are things you did after all the years in school. Loads of children did geography AS because they thought it would be easy. and found out it was actually interesting, dropped another one, took the full A-level in geography, and that's why our lecture is a field level in geography partners. We're in danger with the AS being the motive of a reduction, so we do need to worry about that in the future. And it'd be nice if children did what they do in those semester classes and study many more things and just specialise at such a young age on so few subjects.
May I perhaps suggest perhaps one little step for global domination, which is perhaps we should just make GCSE geography compulsory. So I have friends who have children of similar ages as mine, and they are taking a plethora of GCSEs, and they're having a choice, history or geography. But hang on. Well, we obviously know which one they should take. But again, I think that even at GCSE levels, that broadness and this whole thing about the international baccalaureate, which says you should at least take one humanity, one language, and a science, maths, and English, really undermines what we should be doing, which is they should be taking all the sciences. They should be taking complete humanities. They should be taking one. It should be, again, forget A levels when you get so much narrowed down. You should be still at the age of 15 and 16 taking all the subjects and then making some broader decisions for, say, five subjects at a higher level and then deciding which to do at university.
Thank you very much, both of you, Mark and Danny, for a completely exhilarating evening. I'm of a certain vintage, so I'm so used to geography being binary. I'm never the digital meat, but here you both are, physical geographer, human geographer, demonstrating why dialogue and vision is absolutely essential to the challenges that we face. The 30% extra energy that connects to 50% energy, 30% water by 2030, huge challenges. And it's an enormous honour to both be here tonight at the Royal Geographical Society IGG on this stage, because to my mind this has been the most important lecture we've all heard here. And for those of you who want to watch it again, and I will certainly watch it again, do go and tell fellow members who are not here this evening and your friends or family to look at www.rgs.org and you'll find this lecture on Brianna's website in the future. You'll be having a look at it. So I thank you both very much indeed for your time and your dialogue.